Greetings, Earthlings. This is Robert J., and I'm too lazy to type what I think. Not too lazy to flap my gums a bit. Never know what's gonna come out, so humor me and stick around for a while. What's the worst that could happen? You might even enjoy yourself. So, like you just heard, this is Too Lazy to Type What I Think, and I'm Robert J., and I'm really, really happy to have the guest that I have. We're talking with Randy Rogel, Emmy-winning Randy Rogel, and a lot more than that. He is a West Point graduate. He is a performer. He's... can sing, he can dance, and I don't know how much of that he's done recently. He writes, he's a composer, he's written stage musicals, and probably what he gets the, a lot of acclaim for, I don't know if I can say the most acclaim, but the Animaniacs. And some people of my generation don't know who the Animaniacs are, which is amazing.
That's right.
It's in that spot of maybe our kids' attention. But Randy, thanks for joining me here. I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, Robert, I'm happy to be here. And for those of you who are listening in, actually, Robert's a friend of mine. His wife Jeannie and I went to high school together. She was in the class behind me, right? But so we've gotten to know each other that way, not just professionally but personally too. And you and Jeannie were just over the house for dinner a few weeks ago, if I recall correctly.
It was some scrumptious salmon.
Loved it. Thank you.
So, first off, let's just get this out of the way. How many Emmys have you been awarded?
I have been nominated for 10, and I have won 3. So I've lost more than I've won. We did win the show did win the Peabody Award, which is a fairly, it's kind of like the Pulitzer Prize in radio and television was originally how it was created. And that was for the music I wrote for the show.
But 3 out of 10 is a good baseball average.
I guess so.
You're batting
there was 1 year. There was 1 year where I was nominated against myself, and I lost.
And you lost.
I know. There were like 5 nominees. I was 2 of the 3. You know, 2 of the 5, and I lost. I thought, okay, that's it.
Well, and I did mention this, but you are a West Point graduate, which it's maybe it's just me, but I don't associate people. I hate to use the word showbiz, but you kind of are. But the people in the performing arts, I don't generally associate people in the performing arts with the military academy. So how'd that come about?
I like to tell people it's all those music composition courses I took at West Point that got me where I am. Now, West Point is a hardcore school for soldiers. It's an engineering school. In fact, when I went there, it shows you how old I am. When I graduated, the time I was there, it's a 4-year college. Women were not yet permitted to attend the service academies, either West Point Annapolis or the Air Force Academy. So we were an all-male university, which obviously when you're between the ages of, 18 and 21, 22, that's a horrible thing. But then the year after I left is when women were admitted into the academy. So then they opened up the curriculum after that. I mean, now you can get a political science degree. You can get a degree, I believe, in sociology, a lot of other, the sort of the liberal arts. But when I went there, you had to have an engineering degree. And the amount of electives that would separate you and me, you could count on one hand. Maybe you were chemical engineering, and I was mechanical engineering, or I was electrical engineering, you were civil or ordnance engineering. But everybody graduates with a Bachelor of Science in engineering. So obviously there was no theater influence there. But I had grown up, like you, I was in San Diego, and there was a lot of theater there. And I grew up, as a young kid, I broke into theater, the Professional Theater of the Globe, a place called Circle Arts in Starlight. And so I got my chance to work with a lot of really great people because they used to bring national tours in there. And so I got to be with, you know, highly experienced stars. And I think that helped me and I learned from them. But then when I went to West Point, I was really removed. I mean, I had seen a lot of actors, you know, kind of ended up with dead end careers, but also my dad, like everybody's dad at that time, said, yeah, son, you should get your education. You know, you have something to fall back on. So I listened to that. And somehow I got into West Point because I don't know, it's hard to get in there and it's hard to stay there. But, you know, you have to have a congressman or a senator nominate you. But so when I went there, I left all theater behind me. And I was just, you know, hardcore engineering student, military officer. Then when you graduate from West Point, then you go into the service. In my case, because West Point, it's the Army. And you enter as a second lieutenant, commissioned officer. And I spent most of my time in Europe. I never intended to make the military in my career, but I did do my graduate work while I was there, and that gave me an extra year. So I want to, you know, I like basically counting West Point 10 years service in the military. I got my graduate degree, my master's, and then that's when I got out, and I just needed a job at that time. And you know, married, had a little child, and so I, you know, corporations love junior military officers because we know the chain of command, we know the lines of communication, we all have an education, we're used to working for no money. And so I got swooped up by several. I went with, ended up going with Procter & Gamble, who promoted me. And that's how I ended up in Seattle, where you are. But then I won, and I got promoted a couple of times. I got recruited to other companies, you know. So I was really into corporate life, but I didn't love that. What I wanted to do was work in film and television. And I did a lot of theater. I sort of got back into theater, local theater. For those of you who don't know, Robert lives up in Seattle, and there's a lot of theaters up there. It's a really lovely theater town. And I broke back into professional theater, and that was really fun. But my normal life was a corporate job, and they began to conflict. And then I realized that what do you want to, 20 years from now, what do you want to say you did? And it wasn't, you know, the corporate officer, it was that I wanted to be working in film and television. And so that's when I took the scary leap and I left Seattle, came down, slept on a friend's couch. I left my family there until I could find a place here. And I slept on a friend's couch, a couple months, found a place, and began writing when my family came down. And then I was writing scripts every day. And so and fortunately, after a little bit, I broke into Warner Brothers on Batman.
On Batman.
Of all shows.
What year was that?
I think that was 1991, about.
Well, it sounds sort of funny when you say you broke into Warner Brothers. It's kind of like you had bolt cutters and cut a chain link fence.
I wish it was that easy.
And let them out of the tower.
That's right. I was seeing agents, and agents would, you know, they would read my scripts and they were going, oh, this is pretty good. They'd have me come. And then when they found out I had nothing produced, they were like, oh, no. You know, you're at the wrong level, you know. And so I just, you know, kept writing and submitting to agencies. And finally, I found out, I kind of came to the realization, I'm never going to get this with an agent because they're looking for someone who has a writing degree from USC or a directing degree from UCLA and has experience, you know, has had published television scripts, you know, movies that have been made, so it makes it easy for them to sell you. So I began going directly to the studios themselves. And a friend of mine, a guy named Kelly Ward, and you might not, I knew Kelly in San Diego when we were kids and we did theater together. And Kelly had, when I went off the military, Kelly did very well. He broke into, he did Grease. He was one of the leads with John Travolta in Grease, the movie. He did The Big Red One with Lee Marvin and Mark Hamill. And then he did, you know, lots of episodic TV and all this. So I ran into him when I was here, and he had now was working in animation over Universal. And I told him, yeah, I think I want to be a writer. So I was auditioning and I was making it to like producer level as an actor, but again, no experience. But as a writer, he said, well, there's this new Batman show being done with Warner Brothers, I heard. I didn't know any writers. And he says, it's an animated show. And I thought, oh man, I don't know anything about animation. I don't know how to do that. He goes, oh, no. It's like they're trying to do like these live action show, you know. So he made a call to the producer over there for me. Like I say, they wouldn't even burn a stamp to mail it to me. I had to drive over there and get the Bible, which tells you what the show's about. And then I, you know, after reading it and understanding the characters, I wrote a script for it. And then I submitted it, and it made it right to the showrunner, and he liked it. I met with him, and I wrote another one. And then he says, okay, I'm going to hire you on. But they just hired me on week to week, you know, because they didn't know if I was going to be able to cut it. But, you know, I worked my little butt off there. I was the gang writer for all four story editors, and they had me writing constantly. And then after about, we did that, and about a year and a half later came the end, you know, because you write shows, they go into production. Animation takes 9 months to make a show, you know, from the, we like to say it's like having a baby, you know, from the moment you begin writing till it comes back fully automated. So by that time, like a year and a half later, is when the Emmys came out. And by that time, I'd seen other guys working on Spielberg shows, and I'd wanted to work on that. So they said, no, you write that Batman stuff. It's all dark, you know. But then the first year out, Batman was nominated for the Primetime Emmy. And I won that because the episode they submitted was the one I wrote. So that gave me some real credibility with my voice. Yeah. And then Steven Spielberg, that year he'd been doing Jurassic Park and Saving Private Ryan, is that right? In the same year. So it was... Jurassic Park, and it was two big movies he did in the same year. So he was gone most of the year. And I think those are the two movies. So when he came back, we had this wrap party. And, you know, they'd been submitting stuff, so he would be checking out the episodes. So at the party, he put his arm around, he says, you know, I'm loving these songs. I have another thing I want you to write for me. And I remember as we were walking away, I was like, ooh, you know. And the head of Warner Brothers saw that, and head of Warner Animation saw that. So immediately they came, and I immediately after that, because I'd won the Emmy, I got offers from Disney and others. So Warner Brothers quickly signed me to a deal. And then I, you know, spent about 10 years there and really loved it. Worked with some really talented people, really great writers and producers and animators and artists. So, and then from there, I ended up going to Disney and DreamWorks and all those.
Well, it's a quick lesson in what an arm around the shoulder can do for you.
There it is, exactly. That's all you need.
So is there anybody else? Is there anybody else in your class from West Point that is in the arts at all?
Oh, you know, not that many.
Pretty a small list, I imagine.
They did. I know a few years back, they called me. They were doing an article. You know, they have the West Point, you know, alumni magazine, and they were doing something on West Pointers in the arts. And so they did, I do have one distinction. They said, you're the only West Pointer who's ever won an Emmy. So they interviewed me. Now there is another fellow, but he came after me, and I'm trying to think, he became a movie director, and he did pretty well. He directed that movie, The Castle. I'm trying to think of his name now. Anyway, so he was in the arts too, and made it as a film director. He might have also done some television, but I don't know, because personally, I don't know him. But that's the people I know in the arts from West Point.
So your actual first professional arts gig was Batman.
Well, yeah, I mean, as a kid, I did some theater, but you're right, as a writer, my first professional writing gig was for Batman, which to my good fortune, but I mean, I worked hard on the show too, with a lot of other people, it became an instant hit. So I was working at a major studio on a hit show for a huge network, and that really taught me a lot.
Right.
Yeah, right. You know, because television's a hungry box. You have to meet, you know, really tight schedules and fairly tight budgets too. And, you know, unlike, so like if you're writing a feature film, you can have 9 months to write that script before it goes into production. In television, that's a hungry box. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep making these, you have to work fast, you have to work fast, and you have to work good. And I'll tell you, you know, I notice when I watch TV today, you know, there's a lot of garbage on TV, of course, but there is such good stuff too. I think you could arguably say some of the best writing being done today is being done in television. And you know, I mean, you just go from shows like Game of Thrones and epic scale kind of stuff, really, you know, huge funny comedies. And even things like Breaking Bad, what about Miss Maisel? I mean, all the, you know, right. The shows I'm talking about.
I got to think a lot of that has to do with it. You got more than three networks now. And so more people are getting a chance. People that wouldn't have gotten a chance, you know, 30 years ago are getting a chance now. And so you're getting to find some diamonds in the rough that would have just been kicked to the curb before.
There's never been more opportunity than there is now that, you know, like you say, because there's all of these different networks. But again, at the same time, like Disney owns 20th Century Fox now. They own, you know, Pixar. Right. They own Marvel. So some of them are being scooped up. But there are a lot of outlets, and the other opportunity comes too. You got to have talent, and that's why I would encourage anybody out there who's looking to do this. You know, learn your craft. If you're going to be an artist, if you're going to be a singer, you're going to be a writer, you're going to be a director. Really study it and learn. You know, commit yourself to quality. But I've seen even in my time at Hollywood here in the last, since 20 years, I guess, that you've seen the technology grow in a way where things that used to always be on the lot have moved out into the neighborhood. You know, it used to be all the editing bays were in the studio. When I was there too, we'd go down to the edit bay. Now people out in, you know, in the neighborhood, they have their whole editing session, you know, set up. They, you know, composers composing their music. They can even do, you know, some record for television. They can, you know, you don't have full orchestras. They can orchestrate from Pro Tools, from Digital Performer, from Logic. And you know. Then the idea of even recording, you know, someone now can actually make their own little show. Look at what you're doing, you know, but you can get it filmed, you can get it edited, you can add music underscore. Again, you have to have the talent how to do it.
Right.
And you have to be able to write a script and all that. But you can get a lot of it done yourself. Distribution was the big limiting factor. How are you going to get? And now you got things like YouTube.
Yeah.
I think so. You can even get a YouTube. So everybody now, you know, has their, you go to Facebook and here's this thing, this song I produced, or this little show I produced. So it's pretty cool.
There's a lot more fish in the water now, but it seems like there's a lot more nets now too, as far as getting, you know, being able to make a living or at least getting your stuff seen. Sometimes if you may not make a living at something, but if you write something that you're proud of and the world gets to see it, it's like, well, what can be better than that?
I know it's so hard because I've been on the other side of the table with this where, you know, because I've run television shows. In fact, there's a new season starting. I'm going to be story editing it on a television show I ran. And you know, we get bombarded with scripts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if a studio were to say, hey, we're casting this show. I just wrote a musical, which is going into production now. And working on another one, Jerry Zucker, a Veriplane fan. And if we were to advertise there's an audition, we'd have 1,000 people, you know, around the building. And or thousands of ships coming in, and you just there's no way you can wade through all of that. And so that's why this has become an agent sewed up town, because the agents, the casting directors, they serve as filters. So what you need to do is get yourself, and I know this is difficult, get yourself in front of an agent. And with good material and some and one who's right for you. Now you only need to sort of score once and then you're off and running. But if you get an agent who reads your stuff and says, you know, this actually is not bad, I like this show, and he begins to submit you for stuff, he has access to the producers, to the people who hire you. And at some point or not, I'm assuming you're good. And everybody can be good if you just work at it.
Right.
You're going to get that job. And I always tell young people, go to counsel, and they go, hey, I got right. I said, now, what are you going to do? You are going to write an unbelievably fantastic script. And any notes that you get from the story editor, from the producer, you're going to listen. And you're going to take those and you incorporate it, and you're going to give them a great script. So that, because I know when I'm running a show and I get a great script from a writer, guess what's the first thing I say? Another one.
Yeah.
You know, you go, oh my God, because good writers are coveted. Because you remember, at the end of the day, I mean, everybody's important. Actors are so important, you know, good producers. But if you don't have a good script, it doesn't matter.
Right.
What, you know, how good, you know, your actor's going to try to push that material across the, you know, the screen. But it all starts with a great story and a great script, in my opinion. And I think there's most people would agree with me with that. And so I tell them, you know, write a great script. And I tell you, when I have a writer who writes great script, man, I don't even let other people know about it because I don't want them to take it, you know, him or her. As you want, you know, that's when they sign you to a contract. That's when they sign you to a deal because they want you writing in their show. So you will be highly coveted if you are, I mean, it works in any portion of the business. If you're, you know, a director of photography, or if you're, you know, a sound guy, they, you know, anybody who does quality, that you want them. But once you get that first one, you say, God, it was so hard for me to get somebody to look at my script, but you got that one. Now they like it, they give you another one. Or you talk to the producer and you say, yeah, do you know of any other shows that are going on? Oh, yeah, let me get, and they call and say, hey, this is Robert Lee. He did a great script for me. You should take a look at him. And boom. And of course, your agent says, hey, you know, he, you know, Rand just wrote for this show and that show. And then you're off and running.
Right.
But again, there's millions of dollars in these things, many millions of dollars. And for them to take a chance on you without knowing you,
yeah,
knowing you could cost that, that's what gets people fired. You know, nobody ever got fired for hiring Tom Hanks. You know, that's why when someone's casting a movie or casting a Broadway show, they're always going, can we get a name? Can we get some star attached to it, or someone who's got juice, or and that can be in the writer, could be in the producer. Because then you can go to the boss and say, well, hey, you know, you know, we did Hook. I got Steven Spielberg. I got Robin Williams. I got Dustin Hoffman. You know, it wasn't my fault. You know, but if you, so what you have to understand is they're taking a chance on you. So you need to lower their risk by giving them really great product. And that's what gets your career.
So the next mm-hmm. line here in my notes is, right here.
It's time for Animaniacs, and we're zany to the max. So just sit back and relax, you'll laugh till you collapse. We're Animaniacs.
I remember that song. That song was written by Tom Ruger, who was the creator of the show. He wrote the lyrics, and Richard Stone, who ran the music for all the Warner Brothers animation stuff, wrote the music. I believe they won an Emmy for that song. I'm almost sure of it, and they certainly deserved it. But they were the two that wrote that song, and
can you say
for Tom.
Okay, and I was twiddling with my stuff over here, and I twiddled the wrong slider. So can you give me those names again? That actually,
yes, that song, the theme song. I wrote probably most of the songs for Animaniacs, but the theme song was written by the showrunner and also who was also the creator of the show and who also ran the writing room, Tom Ruger. Tom was the senior creative director over at Warner Brothers during my time there. So he sat over a lot of shows and enormously talented guy. And then Richard Stone, who was basically Carl Stalling reincarnated, you know, wrote the music on it, but we had a live orchestra for that show because of Spielberg. And so Rich was writing for a 45-piece orchestra. We'd go in, and so they wrote that song. It was just great, and it's iconically, you know, associated with the show now.
The so they wrote the baloney in our slacks part too.
Mm-hmm. That would be Tom wrote that.
Okay, because I had a question. Is like did baloney in our slacks come because they were zany to the max, or did zany to the max come because we had to rhyme something with baloney in our slacks?
My guess is, and you'd have to ask Tom Rudin that. My guess is we're zany to the max came first, and then they go, okay, and then, oh, baloney in our slacks again. You have to be careful with that one, because the censors would
right. So, well, now that gets me over to collaboration. When you write, are you a collaborator, or is it all, you got it, it's in your head, it's in your pencil, or do you sit around like the Alan Brady show and Rob and Buddy and Sally and, you know, try this, no, what if we did that? Or do you work better by yourself?
Well, that's a really excellent question, Robert. I think that's a really smart question, too. The answer is both. On Animaniacs, it was really a lot of the Dick Van Dyke Show room, you know, with all of us. But then you go back to your office, we each had our own office, and then begin to write. And the show, any shows like this, you know, the show kind of finds itself, it grows. You know, when you first make it, you're not quite sure what it is. And you're trying, look at, I'll give you an example. Look at The Simpsons. Did you ever see the first, you know, season of The Simpsons?
I remember when they were part of The Reader.
Before
they were animated.
and Nancy Cartwright is Bart Simpson. She was in Animaniacs, and she's a good friend. And a lot of the other people there that were on that show. Just one of the best shows ever in television history. But when you watch the first season two, they hadn't found themselves yet. And then James Brooks came on board and was guiding them with the scripts. I talked to Jeff, he was one of the writers. He told me that Jim Brooks had a lot to do with bringing the heart to it, but they figured out what worked for the show, and then it just was solid. MASH, way back, for those of you old enough to remember that show, which was a big hit in the 70s when we were going to high school. MASH, if you saw the first episodes, those characters were not who they were. Ended up, you know, Radar was this zany little guy who was mailing parts of a Jeep home, you know, and
he was the same guy from the movie, actor.
Exactly. The same guy from the movie. But then they found that the show worked, kind of, you know, had a serious side to it. So all shows do that. And, you know, you get better as you go along. So Animaniacs, they were trying, you know, we had all these different franchises. It was what they call a magazine show, kind of like Rocky and Bullwinkle. Well, you'd have Dudley Do-Right, then you'd have Fractured Fairy Tales, and you have, you know, the Rocky Bullwinkle cartoon. We had these little franchises in there. And it really kind of morphs Tom was running it all, but as we wrote, we could see whose strengths were where, and Paul Rugg really kind of became the voice of the Warners. He wrote most of the Warner cartoons. Peter Hastings became the Pinky and the Brain guy. He really wrote most of the, you know, Pinky Brain, you know, became, I think he really helped define who those characters finally were. Again, we did all this under Tom's guidance, and I became the music guy. As I ran more and more songs, I was writing all those songs. You know, but Sherry Stoner, John McCann, we're all doing great. Diane Oliver, they're all doing just terrific work. And so that's how that show kind of came to be what it was. And we each, you know, morphed. It was nice for me because I was the music guy, so Spielberg gave me they wheeled a piano into my office, so I had a piano in my office, like on the Dick Van Dyke Show. But then when I'm writing songs, generally, you know, I'll get together with Tom, people will think about what would be the idea for the song. But then I go back to my office and I work in solitude, usually when I'm composing. But right now I'm working with Jerry Zucker on his new musical, very, very funny, Tom Kitt, who did Next to Normal, he's doing the music. Lyrics, and I'm just helping with some of the lyrics. And I mean, we're in constant meetings. All, you know, tomorrow, I told you we're starting a third season of, it's called 1001 Nights. I ran that show for a number of years, so I'll be story editor on this one. But I mean, we're going to be in meetings tomorrow. That's going to be all about, all right, Rob, I need 10 ideas from you, Robert. We need 10 ideas. And we're gonna go. So all of that's going on in a collaborative basis. But then once we narrow it down, we go, okay, Robert, you're going to do that script. or, you know, like, come up, give me an outline by Friday. And then you go off and you do your thing. Very few people I know just absolutely always work in the same room as somebody else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I guess it's whatever just you're comfortable with.
The Animaniacs in Concert has been a thing now for a few years.
Yes.
How many a year are you guys doing?
Well, we were doing a lot, but then COVID hit.
Yeah.
And we were shut down for the better part of 2 years, like a year and a half, 2 years. We had just signed with ICM too, which is a big agency. So they had us booked, and we were going to go do them, but COVID shut those shows. They had to stop cancel those shows. So we're stopped. We're going to get going again and get booking again. But I'm sorry to say the show hit, but COVID shut down 9 Broadway shows. ICM told me like 50% of their shows were down because audiences were just afraid to go into, really go into theaters, because in our business, they're all sitting right next to each other, So hopefully in the next 6 months where we'll be back on our feet, because we have to have new representation that gets us out there. And then, they have to book you into the next season. So
this is almost a private conversation. So if you could tell our audience, what is Animaniacs in Concert?
Oh, sure.
Because it's a cartoon. How can it be in concert? What are they talking about?
Yeah, no, Animaniacs in Concert is just a wonderful show. It's a live stage show where we do the music of Animaniacs, but a lot of the really funny, clever songs, but tell the stories of them. And we actually say, you want to hear the original version of that song before they made us cut it or change it. We do songs like, you want to hear the song that Steven Spielberg said, you're not doing that, or the network says, you cannot do that song. So, but what's really fun about it is Rob Paulsen, who plays Yakko, who plays Pinky and Pinky the Brain. He's two of the Ninja Turtle. I mean, Rob's done hundreds of voices and thousands of hours of television. So he and I do the show at the piano, but we've done it we bring Maurice LaMarche. Maurice is the brain and Pinky and the Brain, but Maurice also does a lot of the characters on Futurama, on The Simpsons, on Disenchanted. He's a big, big voiceover artist. These guys are all fantastic at improv. So we come out on stage, these guys begin to riff, and they go into those voices, and the audience goes nuts. Sometimes I have to say, guys, we have to get back to the show now. So we've done it with symphony orchestras. We just did a few months ago. We were in Virginia. We did it with a huge symphony orchestra there. We did it in Phoenix with an orchestra. But a lot of times, like, we've done it at the Public Theater with just Rob and me at the piano, or I've done it with where we just recently with Maurice and me and Rob just at the piano too, which is a little bit more of an intimate show. But you don't need, in order to enjoy this show, Animaniacs in Concert, you do not need to be a kid. Most of our audience are adults. I mean, kids like the show too, but it's very hip for adults, and you don't have to know Animaniacs. It's just fun right on its own. Fun, clever, and very engaging. So we have a website called, Animaniacs Live or Animaniacs in Concert. And when we get going again, we'll post where we're going to be. And if you get a chance to go anywhere your area, you should really see the show.
I know
we've done it both in Seattle and Portland.
We've seen you about 3 times. The first time.
That's right. Well, you should be telling me what you think of the show.
In San Francisco was the first time. And we just looked around us, and the place was just absolutely geeked out. The people standing in line to, the meet and greet, and the people were just totally, it was like, and we saw you in Seattle. In San Diego.
Oh, yes, we did at the Balboa Theater during the Comic-Con. Oh, that was such a beautiful theater.
Yeah.
And, and that one we brought Mark Mann on because we had a combo band, which gave it a whole little jazz feel. Yeah, that was really a fun show. So, you have to, it's not good for, because I'm in the show and I wrote it, so it's not,
it is.
For me to say it's a good show, other people have to say it's a good show.
Well, if it wasn't a good show, you wouldn't keep doing it, I imagine, but we enjoy it all the time, and it's funny, and just to look at the talent of, that's on the stage, whether it's just you and Rob, or whether you add the other people too. And I think in San Francisco, you had all 3 Warners.
That's right. We had Jess Harnell.
Yep.
We had Tress McNeil. And Tress is arguably the most successful female voiceover artist in history. She's done even more than June Foray. She's done the 500 episodes of The Simpsons. She's a regular on Futurama. And every when they did Tiny Toon, she was Babs Bunny. She was Dot in Animaniacs. She has done more voice. So when she comes,
right,
you know, the audiences just go completely nuts. And, and then, of course, Rob Paulsen and Maurice is Pinky in the Brain. The place goes just ape, you know.
Well, and, yeah, and people who, you know, not everybody knows those names, mm-hmm, right? But everybody knows, you know, the characters. But the people that were there knew the actors. Yeah, when we were in San Francisco.
Yeah, they do. So that, you're that, right.
That's what I was talking about, the geek factor of, you know.
Well, it's like when Nancy, I've been with her place, and suddenly she starts talking as Bart Simpson, and people go, oh, my God, that's Bart Simpson? Or that, you know, Billy West. Oh, my God, that's Fry and Zoidberg and Zap Brannigan on Futurama, or Tress playing moms. I mean, you know, these are very famous voices that you don't know, and you go, oh, my God, this is the person who does it. It's kind of a cool right, factor.
That's that is a lot of fun. It's fun to watch Rob do the countries.
That was the first song I wrote for him, and he does that beautifully, doesn't he?
Yeah, but then you changed them because the countries have changed since you wrote it. the one night we were at, and what's impressive is that he can stand and do it without a scrap of paper and just boom. Yeah. And I can't.
Yeah, in fact, I heard you probably heard this in the show, but I was out of town when they recorded that song because Warner Brothers would let me go do shows. So I was performing and singing the rain at the Paper Room. And I got a call from Rusty Mills, who's passed away now, but Rusty, who directed that episode. And he sent me a cassette tape, guys, in those days. So I got a FedEx tape of him singing it. And I said, my God, who is this guy? He's really good. I hadn't even met Rob yet. We were just starting. And he sang that song. And Rusty said, Randy, he did it in one take. I was like, wow.
Yeah. Well,
pretty impressive.
For those who, what's it called? Yakko's World?
Yakko's World.
Yakko's World. So anybody who would like to see what we're talking about, you can see that on YouTube. And you'll be impressed. Wait till this you're done listening to this, but then go over to YouTube and check out Rob and Rob and Randy's work together. What about Hysteria?
Hysteria was a cool idea by Tom Ruger to do a show about history because in Animaniacs we did do a lot of songs and things about, you know, people, place, things, space, you know, again, countries, geography. And so history was always, you know, a very cool, you know, thing to delve into. And so Tom decided to do a show on history. And I said, oh, man, I love history. So he said, we need a song to sell it. So that's when I wrote the one with the history of war and all that. So I like to say the songs were good. Because I won, in fact, that year I won the Annie Award, which is kind of the Emmy within the animation industry. Mark Shaman won it for movies, and I won it for television, for the songs. So Hysteria has some great songs, but the show was not a hit, although it had some wonderful moments. But it was really a well-conceived idea, I thought, of doing history. So there's a lot of people who are really, you know, dedicated to that show. Love it. But I know when we do the songs during Animaniacs and concerts, we get a huge response. Everybody loves those songs. We do the spice trade. We do the history of the Roman Empire, all the plays of Shakespeare, those kind of things.
I don't know if it's too soon, but I would like to see a good satirical song about Putin.
About Putin, huh?
That would be... you'd be a hit of the underground in Russia right now, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, I like to just take a philosophical moment here, ladies and gentlemen, in that you really know a look around the world, and where you see countries that are able to laugh at themselves, countries with a humor, sense of humor, where you can make fun of the president. You can, people every day get up and are constantly making fun of people in power, you know, you have a very legitimate government. They truly represent, because they're not afraid of being criticized because they are legitimately elected by the people. And whenever you see someone in power who doesn't have a sense of humor, that's an indication immediately to me that they're not legitimate or they are very insecure. Try telling a Kim Jong-il joke in North Korea, or stand up in Iran and tell an Ayatollah joke, or yep. stand up in the days of Saddam Hussein and tell a joke about Saddam Hussein. Hell, if you were in Russia right now and you made a, you like you were saying, I wrote a funny Putin, I'd have to be very careful who was my audience and where I was at.
Or who was mixing and your drinks.
That's right. And that tells me, because they have no sense in, they can't stand to be scrutinized. They cannot stand to be criticized, investigated. That's a regime that's not legitimate.
I agree.
So that humor is the foundation of I think, of a great society. People who like, wherever people love to laugh and that, you know, poke fun at not just at other things, but poke fun at themselves.
Right.
Look at The Simpsons. I mean, The Simpsons make such fun of American life. You know, the stupidity of Homer and all that. It just shows how secure we are.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, we can make fun of ourselves.
Well, and they get the actors and athletes and whatnot to come on in caricature and be themselves, yeah. knowing that part of them is going to be made fun of, and they dig it.
They do. It's like, you know, and remember, usually, almost all the time, humor is rooted in some truth.
Right.
That's what makes you laugh about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. When we watched the Oscars last night, Amy, oh, what's her last name? Who hosted it?
Poland. Poland.
Yeah. Very funny girl. But she said, and then, you know, because she has to say something about the movies, and she says, and then, you know, let's talk about Aaron Sorkin, who's a big hero of mine. I've met Aaron. He's just a brilliant writer. And so Aaron Sorkin, what a brilliant guy. Who else could write an entire movie about Lucille Ball and that show, the Lucille, and not have one laugh? You know, and everybody started laughing. You know, it's good. And I'm sure Aaron Sorkin, he wasn't there, but he would have laughed too. But then, of course, that was the point. Everybody's laughed at the Lucy show. What he did, we show you the other side.
Right.
And anybody can get you to laugh at that. He can just show you something. What he did was to show, not make you laugh, but to see the truth behind it. So that was, she got the laugh out of it, but that was, you know.
Right.
I'm sure Aaron Sorkin wouldn't mind at all that she said that. He'd laugh himself. Unfortunately, there was one joke told last night that someone did not have a sense of humor about.
That's true.
And we see what that leads to, don't we?
Yep. It's best to laugh at yourself. And who knows? I don't know how much alcohol had been consumed prior to, or that has that kind of effect on some people. What about?
I don't know.
Yeah. I'm curious. What's the last time you performed professionally, as far as either on a stage or
normally,
in front of a camera? And I don't mean The Simpsons or the Animaniacs, but you know, like you did Singing in the Rain before.
Right. Oh, it's been a while, because I mean, really, you know, when you run a TV show, actually, there was a time I was running a TV show and I allowed myself to be cast in the Danny Kaye role in White Christmas, right? And my girlfriend said, you know, that's a lot to do. It's Christmas time. We're kind of slow at the studio. Oh my God, it almost killed me. I was working 8 hours. I thought, I'll never do this again.
What year
was that? As long as I'm running, huh?
What year was that?
Oh God, that's probably 8 years ago now. I mean, it's been a while. But again, and then writing shows. Like I wrote a musical that was done at Seattle. We wrote another one, which is now going into production. So Animaniacs in Concert really is my chance to get up and perform. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't think to have the chance to actually stop what I'm doing and go to rehearsal all day and just be doing a show, that'd be tough on me right now. And that's because I'm just busy as ever writing and composing for these other shows.
And being the same age as me, I'm sure you've stopped doing your own stunts too.
Well, when I did Sing in the Rain, I would run up the wall and flip off it. So I don't know if I would do that now. Yeah.
So tell me about the, I know we talked briefly about it the musical that you're wrapping up right now. What can you tell us about it?
It's called Did You See What Walter Paisley Did Today? And it's a it's very much in the vein of Little Shop of Horrors. It's got a funny horror comedy to it. We did. I brought on B.T. McNichol. I was writing it, and he's developed it. You know, so he's the guy who sits there with me, saying this works, that doesn't work. He's a great director. He was Mike Nichols' right hand guy. He's just a brilliant director, and he runs a theater too. So we did it in closed readings. Nobody was allowed to come except the creative team. And of course the actors, we hired all pros. And we did several readings. I would do rewrites, blah, blah, you know, back and forth over a period of about a year, year and a half. And then it really got to the place where we thought, this is ready. So the theater brought in some of their subscribers, 300 a night for two nights. And we got an overwhelming response. So I got the phone call. They go, we're going to full production. And that means now they spend the many hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, for sets and costumes and orchestrations and all that's going on now. We were going to open in August, but the theater said, we'd really like more time to market the show in our regular seasons. We said, sure. So now it will open, it will go in rehearsal like February and open late February, March.
Of 23.
Yeah, like about a year from now. And then the other one I'm working on is the Jerry Zucker musical, which is going to have its reading in New York next month in about 3 weeks, 4 weeks. So that, and then, but so, they're both terrific shows.
So where's,
if you get a chance to see them, you'll.
What's the guy's name?
Did You See What Walter Paisley Did Today? Okay. It's from an old movie by the same guys who did Little Shop of Horrors.
Where's it going to be?
It'll be at the La Mirada Theater in La Mirada here in Southern California. It's about, I think, 1,200, 1,300 seat theater. It's beautiful theater. And I've worked there. In fact, we did an animation concert there a couple of years ago. And so it'll be done there. And then from there, we planned it will go to New York to be presented to all the producers to take it to the next step from there. It's just on its track and we'll see. I like it, but that's not up to me. It's up to the audience.
Right.
So the audience, so far the audience has been giving us a thumbs up. So and we'll see if they continue to do that.
I don't mean this as an insult at all, but is it the type of thing that could end up on Netflix or one of the Hulu or something as a film production?
Well, why would that be an insult?
Well, I don't know. Maybe insult's the wrong word. As if to say, well, it's not going to make it in theater, so let's just.
I see what you're saying. No, it probably would do. I mean, the normal scenario I would think is because it's written for the stage. It would go to the stage, and if it was successful on the stage, then it played like Hulu might say, "Oh, well, we would like to get the film rights."
Well, like
to
Little
it.
Shop.
That's usually how that happens. Like Little Shop, exactly. Yeah. Little Shop was a highly successful show. And so then they said, well, let's make a movie. So it usually goes that direction. Although you see a lot of Broadway shows that come from movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, right now I was just talking to our choreographer. He's in New York. He's doing Beetlejuice on Broadway.
Wow.
And, you know, Groundhog Day. Name a movie that hasn't been turned into a Broadway show. Most of them do not make it.
Yeah.
But some of them... I thought the Full Monty did really well. Of course, that's David Yazbek's music, and he's brilliant. Even the band's Visit, which he wrote, which was terrific, won like 10 Tonys. That was taken from a movie.
And so what's the other show? You said you had another one that was...
Oh, the other show is by Jerry Zucker called Intermission. And if you've ever seen Airplane, or if you've seen the Naked Gun series... Surprisingly, Jerry directed Ghost, which was a terrific movie. It's like one of the AFI's top 50, top 100. But it's, you know, it's got more of a serious nature to it. But Jerry directed that. But this script is one of the funniest I've ever seen. Because if you know, like when you watch Airplane or those Naked Gun, you can't go, three or four lines before you get hit with another joke. This is like that.
Yeah.
And it's such a delight to work on it because the guy's really a comic genius.
No, is this a play or is this a musical?
It's a musical. Right,
okay.
It's a big, fat Broadway musical. Big. It's a, you know, huge cast, huge sets, huge effects, and funny as hell.
Well, the Yeah, we talked about Aaron Sorkin briefly before, and that's mm-hmm. you know, that's one of the guys that, like, Jeannie and I, if we know that he's written something, we'll make it a point to watch it, mm-hmm. because you know, his dramas have comedy, because mm-hmm. that's real life. I don't know anybody's life that I know very few people's lives that have no laughter in them, even during serious times, even during mm-hmm. tragic times. Real life has laughter in it. And to me, when I see a movie that's just serious and it's just, you know, gut-wrenching, and I don't get to laugh in it, it's like, this isn't real.
And you're absolutely right. And see, you want the highs and the lows.
Yeah.
Because that may, the, you know, the audience gets to take this bigger journey. You know who's really good at that, believe it or not? I mean, you just maybe didn't think of it, is Steven Spielberg. Spielberg can... I mean, I work with him on anime, you know, but on a limited basis. But he always can find the humor in something, and get a gag in there to break the tension. Well, even in Schindler's List, which is one of the darkest movies, he got an honest to God laugh. And do you remember what it was? Remember where he put it?
I can't.
Because he wanted to break the tension.
Yeah.
Do you remember what the laugh was?
No, I don't.
The laugh was this, that the inside the camp, this German Gestapo agent pulls all the Jews out of the barracks and said, all right, who stole the loaf of bread? And nobody will answer. And so he says, I'm going to start shooting people in the head one at a time until someone confesses to the crime. And no, they're sitting there scared and nobody will, you know, will say who took the bread. So he walks up to one guy and blam, shoots him and kills him right there. The guy falls dead on the floor. And then this little boy begins to cry. And the Gestapo agent, you know, kneels down. He goes, do you know who stole the bread?
Yes.
He goes, you want to tell me now? He goes,
yes.
He goes, who was it? And he points at the dead guy and goes, it's him. See, now that worked just beautifully. And Aaron Sorkin is actually one of the funniest people, you know, what he writes. You know who else could do it? Think about it. Was Neil Simon. Neil Simon could write comedy, 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 and then all of a sudden, like, I remember watching The Star-Spangled Girl, where two guys suddenly, they get into this argument, and it gets really serious. Like, these were friends, and they're hate each other now, and they're going to have a fight. And it just gets really dark. And then they come running at each other, they collide elbows, go, ah! And it goes right back into the funny stuff. And so if you can do that, like, did you see The Newsroom by Aaron Sorkin?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look at all the funny, funny stuff in that. But, you know, one thing you said about Aaron Sorkin is really what Hollywood's all about, is Aaron Sorkin. If you and I, like you said, if you know Aaron Sorkin wrote it, you'll go watch it. How valuable does that make Aaron Sorkin to the studios?
Oh, really?
If they can get him on board the project, it's like, if I can get, used to be, like, I get Tom Cruise, or I can get Paul Newman way back then, you know, for Robert, you know, you get those people, I'm going to have a successful movie because people are going to come to see it because they're in it.
Right.
And he's won that status as a writer. Very few writers have ever had that status. And he's a great director, too. Have you seen the movies he's directed? He directed Molly's Game. He directed The Trial of Catonsville IX. He's a very good director, too, because he was just, you know, a little nervous starting out in that. But he's been schooled by people. I went to see Molly's Game at the Writers Guild before it came out in theaters. And he was there. And so he was saying, yeah, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I had this guy, they assign editors to me, they assign cameramen, you know, people with all this experience. You go, no, don't do that. Do that. You know, so he thanked them prolifically, but he did a terrific job, I thought. So that guy is one of the most talented people in Hollywood today, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's we just watch that and we just look at each other and just go, oh my God. Yeah, I'm crying because I'm going, this is just unbelievable, you know, unbelievably beautiful writing, and it's just holy moly.
He really does. He really's got it. I mean, like, you know, he started with A Few Good Men as a young man, and that became a hit play. But now, To Kill a Mockingbird is the most successful play in history, I think, in terms of money it's made, because he adapted that. And of course, that's just so in his wheelhouse,
right,
to write that, you know. And so I can't wait to see it. It's going to be on tour. It's coming, and I'm definitely going to see that.
Well, what we, you know, became fans of was The West Wing.
Oh,
and just watch that, and we go, oh my gosh! But they talked about all of the, all of his stuff was all the walking and talking, and just follow. Well, shoot, Randy, I appreciate the time that you spent here with me, and
my pleasure,
getting
Robert.
To shoot the bull a little bit and learn some stuff. I learned some stuff, and I hope the audience has learned some stuff. And this should
well, it's been nice, sort of sitting around the fire with you here and talking. It's great.
And this should be hopefully, if everything has come out right in my machine here. I won't have to do much tweaking at the end.
And oh, good. Do you put any effects on your, you know, like a little compression, a little reverb, anything like that?
A little bit, but I have a little bit of that in the machine itself.
Oh, okay.
And so once it gets to, it just depends on how it turns out. You know, sometimes I just have to, all I have to do is take one track and maybe, you know, bring it back a little bit. And, but yeah, I don't have to do too much with it. And again, if it was music, that'd be a different story. But
Well, good. Well, then I've been very happy to be your guest, and I hope your guests have found me fun to talk to listen to or to talk with you.
Well, thanks a lot, Randy.